KaiserNetwork.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Topsy Turvy Part 2, or the second part of the doubleheader, or whatever this metaphor leads you to. I'm Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform, and I want to just take a second to thank Drew and Diane and the rest of the Kaiser team here for their constancy, not just in supporting the Alliance and the joint work we do in a variety of ways, but also, I think, more importantly, in sort of contributing generally to healthcare policy enlightenment over all these years. Very pleased to be here, especially in the Barbara Jordan Conference Center, one of the great places to talk about health policy and try to shape it. Now, I may not do a very good Cal Ripken imitation, but some say, at least in the context of Congress, that we've got a whole new ballgame. And at the very least, we know that at one end of Pennsylvania Avenue, we have a new pitching staff. Even before we know exactly where the 109th Congress and the President are going to leave health policy, and you found on your chairs at least the best guess about part of that last-minute action, we're going to look today at what the 110th Congress, working with, at least working on the same issues as President Bush, might do in the coming couple of years. Let me just say, Diane Rowland, the Executive Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and I will be sort of co-moderating this. Diane, do you want to say a few words as we kick off here?
I'm just pleased to have you all join part two. I will do no sports metaphors because part of the Kaiser Family Foundation avoids that, even though the other part leads with it. And I'm very glad to have you all here today and that we could do a doubleheader in terms of having both the first panel look at the public expectations, but now we're going to really talk about the hard work of taking those expectations into policy and into reality and the challenges facing the next Congress. And I'm just very pleased to be with everyone on the panel today, but especially I wanted to say thank you to Liz Hall, who has been a partner in helping us put together so many of these Alliance briefings over the last years, and to wish her well in her new endeavors. So thank you, and let's get on with the program.
Very good. Thanks, Diane. I don't want to rush Julie Goon, who has managed to make it to our panel. It's part of the new just-in-time inventory system that the administration is installing. But we're very pleased that you were able to break away. It looks like the logistics of this are such that you should plan on speaking from where you are as opposed to coming to the podium, if that's okay.
That's fine. And if you want to have somebody else go first while I gather things for a minute, that's fine, too.
We can do that, if that's all right. Let me. You can see we're making this up.
I'll get up and talk.
Whatever you want.
It's your choice. Either we will maybe have Kate talk about the Senate along with Liz, and then maybe you can interpose, and then we'll have Wendell finish up.
Sure.
Is that all right?
Sure. However you want to.
Is it all right with Kate and Liz? You can see we have this very well orchestrated. Well, let's do that then, if that's okay with you. Kate actually has to leave early, so it's only right that she should go first. Kate Leone is, I apologize for the introductions. We want to save more time for the actual remarks and insights that we're going to hear. Kate Leone is the senior health counsel to Senate Democratic leader, soon to be majority leader, Harry Reid of Nevada. She also handled health issues for the previous Democratic leader, Tom Daschle. She's an attorney by training, and we're very pleased that you made time for us today, Kate.
Do I do this? Okay. Thanks very much for having me. This is a great occasion, and I'm sorry that it comes during a week when everything is so frazzled, still on the Hill, and running in and running out, because I would have liked to have spent more time here. But unfortunately, I guess we can start with the agenda for next year by saying that is a work in progress. We will probably know more about in the next 2 days. Right now, I don't know if people are aware sort of what's going on other than the extenders package. The extenders package is the big news, and I can talk about that in a minute. But we have another set of unresolved issues. Liz and I have been spending quite a bit of time together over the past month trying to resolve a number of things and see if we can't make progress on a few items. There's a House passed reauthorization of the National Institutes of Health. It's unclear whether that's going to make it through the Senate. Tied into that is whether the Ryan White Care Act makes it through the House and whether the bioterrorism reauthorization, which is combined with the BARDA bill that a lot of people are very interested in the biotech community, whether that makes it through. Is that it all sort of hinges on the NIH either way. And so I guess what we're looking at right now are a lot of people who want to see some changes to the Children's Health Insurance Program so that we can address the shortfalls that a lot of states are going to experience in this fiscal year that we have already started. And all of that sort of is hanging out there as unresolved at this point. And I don't think we know where it's going to go. You'll notice that the Children's Health Insurance Program shortfall issue did not make it into the extenders package. It was a part of the Senate bipartisan package didn't come out of the Finance Committee, but that the Finance Committee leaders put together. So that was sort of taken off the table during the negotiations. And I think that for a lot of us, a lot of people in the Senate, certainly a lot of people in the House, but on a bipartisan basis in the Senate, that was a disappointment for us. More so probably for a number of Senate Democrats who are now saying, we're going to do CHIP or nothing else is going to happen. So I think we're in that position, and the House has taken the position that the Senate's going to do NIH or Ryan White and bioterrorism aren't going to happen. So we're sort of butting heads, and hopefully we will get to a resolution where we can do all of those things and make a lot of progress. But I think that's all still hanging out there. Clearly for next year, that leaves unanswered whether one of the first things we're going to be taking up is Ryan White, and whether the first things we're going to be taking up is CHIP shortfalls, and whether one of the first things we're going to be taking up is bioterrorism. So I think clearly if NIH doesn't get through right now, it's not going to be one of the first things that we do next year. There's just too many other moving pieces that are going to be needed to be done. So that's all sort of up in the air about whether that's immediate congressional agenda for January, February. The extenders package, obviously, I won't say it's all done and going to pass. We're hopeful it'll pass, and that takes off the table for the immediate January period, having to deal with the physician cut, which would be terrific with all the other things that are going to be on our plates. So clearly, if the moving pieces come together, and let's put those aside, I can talk about what our agenda would be if we got all these things done in the next 3 days. Obviously, the Senate Democrats and the House Democrats share the 6 for 06 agenda that we put out. On that agenda are 2 health items, Medicare negotiation and stem cell research. Leader Pelosi has put out a 100 hours agenda that I'm sure you're all familiar with, and Wendell can speak to more. Anyone who watches Congress knows that the 100-hour agenda in the Senate means maybe one thing, maybe 2 things. So we're not going to be on the 100-hour schedule. But these are our priorities. We share these priorities, and they are going to be the first things we consider as we come back. And I think stem cells has clearly seen the light of day. We've made a lot of progress on it. Wendell can probably speak more to it than I can because he has worked more closely on it in recent years than I have. But I think we can expect to consider stem cells, hopefully send it to the president, see where we go from there. We went through this exercise last year, or this year, I guess, and got the veto. We'll see what happens with that one. On Medicare negotiation, again, the House and Senate sort of are on a little bit of different timing tracks. We plan to see what our committee folks have to say about it in the Finance Committee and have them take a look at it. Senator Baucus has indicated he'd like to have hearings on the issue and figure out what the best way to go about it is. I know the House folks are proceeding along as well, and I think, you know, we're on similar tracks. We're not as far apart as we often are and as appears to be in this week as we look at all these other issues. But we are we're going to move along and see what we can get going through the Finance Committee in regular order and hopefully get something to the floor in the first few months. It's unclear sort of what we're going to do when at this point. That has not been determined. I think one of the early health care issues on the floor also will not be something that is something that is on our agenda. It's small business health care, but will not be coming from our side in this case, because I think we're still going to look through and figure out where we want to be on small business health care. But I do understand that as Democrats put minimum wage on the floor, which is one of our 6406 pieces, that Senator Enzi's staff has indicated on previous panels that they plan to offer the Enzi Small Business Health Plan bill to that piece of legislation. Whether that happens or not is a question for Senator Enzi and the Republican leadership, but that could be an early health care issue that's on the floor that is not necessarily framed in a way that Democrats will support, but perhaps we can get something done for small businesses as part of that, and I think that would be a hope that we could come to some kind of agreement that gets us a number of votes in the Senate, gets us past the thresholds we need, and we can send over to the House. So those are sort of the early big-ticket items, all hinging on today, and I suppose, sadly to say, maybe tomorrow and the next day. But we're keeping our fingers crossed for today still. So thanks very much.
Have a nice weekend. thanks very much, Kate. Now let's hear from Liz Hall. She's the Director of Health Policy for Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, who also happens to be the Vice Chair of the Alliance for Health Reform, in full disclosure mode. She's an expert in Medicare and health IT and a bunch of other health topics. She's here to help us understand how the Republicans in 2007 are going to deal with a whole range of issues. And let me just echo and reiterate and magnify the remarks that Diane made about how much we have relied on and successfully relied on Liz Hall to handle an incredible array of onerous duties that we have heaped on her from the Alliance, and she has discharged them all beautifully. And we're going to miss working with you directly in that way, but we hope that we can continue with the relationship in wherever else you go. Liz, thanks for being with us today.
Well, and thank you for having me, and thank you to everyone who has come out. I can tell that this is a topic of interest to the audience. It has been wonderful to work with the Alliance and with the Kaiser Family Foundation for a number of years, and I, too, will very much miss participating as directly, but as the leader made clear at the last Alliance board meeting, he will not be going far, and he will not stop participating because he does feel that the Alliance does serve such an important role, and I think that he and Senator Rockefeller will continue to do everything that they can to make sure that there is a strong bipartisan dialogue on health issues. It's too important not to have that dialogue. And to a certain extent, I'm actually here to represent that perspective a little bit. When Ed mentioned that the Alliance was working with Kaiser on putting this together, one of the things that I mentioned is that the nature of the Senate and the nature of the margins in the Senate make it such that there will need to be strong bipartisan discussion and work to really accomplish some of the goals that I think that either Democrats or Republicans have for the future. So I'll start out my remarks by just kind of talking about the nature of the Senate and reminding folks of the nature of the Senate. We try to keep it a collegial place. Absolutely on the floor. The debates sometimes get a little bit less collegial, but the idea is to try and work towards agreement behind the scenes. The reality is it only takes one to try to stop and block something in the Senate, and it requires 60 to invoke cloture and to end debate. So because of that, it's important to remember that while 51 is a majority, and I think that the Democrats are very glad to have 51 as the majority, it's a diverse majority, and I think that they will have a lot of Republicans to work with. There's a lot of, I think, common ground to be found, but there are going to be some significant differences. speaking from experience, and I think that's actually why I'm here today, it is a lot harder to try to put together agreement, as Kate and I are experiencing right now as we try to close out the session, than it is to really foment fierce debate. We can challenge ideas, but it is very difficult to come together on ideas that we can move forward. But that said, I think Kate mentioned sort of what is the some of the democratic agenda, and I'll just mention some areas where I think that there is great opportunity for bipartisan work and bipartisan agreement, as well as a few areas where I think there might be a little bit more fierce debate. In the area of working together, regardless of whether we are able to address SCHIP reallocation of some of the funds and addressing some of the shortfalls in the short term, SCHIP reauthorization is due next year, and I think that there'll be a significant discussion and debate, and there's a significant interest from the Republican perspective of trying to get that reauthorization done and done as quickly as possible. It just may be combined with some of the allocation issues early on. I would say that we've got great relationships. One other thing I would say about just the Senate in general, we've got great relationships between the chairman on the two committees of jurisdiction. And I think that that will be very helpful. One of the priorities for Senators Enzi and Kennedy, I know, has been drug safety. And next year we happen to find ourselves on the HELP committee looking at reauthorization of several FDA-related pieces of legislation. So I think that that will be a significant focus. And I think that also is a significant area for bipartisan agreement and work. Health IT, unfortunately, I think we've gotten to a stalemate with the House, between the House and the Senate, on moving health information technology legislation forward. I think it's very likely that we'll be able to revive that and hopefully move that pretty quickly. There's been a lot of good work that's been done, and a lot of ideas that have been very well developed, and I think that we can work on that on a bipartisan basis. And yeah, as Kate mentioned, Ryan White is another challenge that we are trying to face. And regardless of whether we're able to get the Senate compromise through, I think that early next year and the next Congress, there will need to be continuing bipartisan discussions on the structure of that program and the future of that program. We absolutely want to make sure that we protect all of those who are affected by HIV/AIDS for the next 3 years, and that's what the legislation and the compromise does. But we also need to think about the changing face of the epidemic and the future. And so I think that there will be significant additional discussion on that one. Where we may not find such consensus are a number of areas, and I think areas that we'll have to work on very, very closely. I think that we worked hard on a bipartisan basis to get the Medicare Modernization Act passed. I think that there are some things potentially on the Democratic agenda that would make changes to that, and I think that that's one area where I think there will be some significant differences. I think that there have been some discussion of some Medicare Advantage changes, the Medicare Advantage program, which offers private plans to Medicare beneficiaries. Again, an area where I think there are some significant differences. And if you're hearing some of the discussion about Medicare Advantage base rates versus fee-for-service payment rates, those aren't apples-to-apples comparisons, and I think there'll be significant discussion about that in the future. I would say that the discussion of drug importation, clearly there are Republicans very supportive of drug importation. There are Republicans who are very much opposed. I think there's a similar situation on the Democratic side where you've got some differences of opinion amongst the Democratic caucus. So that's another area where I think there will be some debate. And then depending on what Democrats may or may not want to do on consumer-driven health care and health savings accounts, again, something that Republicans worked very hard to establish consumer-driven options. They're not perfect, and we continue to work to try to enhance them and do things to facilitate the ease of use and the ability to make decisions through quality, which I should mention is another area where I think we can find some bipartisan support on the quality agenda. But I think when it comes to exactly how consumer-driven health plans work and health savings accounts, again, I think that's another area where there might be some significant differences. So with that, in short, it's I think going to be very interesting. I will not be in the Senate next year. I am moving on to other places, but I hope to be able to provide some assistance and guidance to both Republicans and Democrats in my new role. So,
terrific. Thanks very much, Liz. Now, we're going to lead off with Julie Goon, who's a special assistant to the President Bush for economic policy within the National Economic Council. Julie has responsibility for all the major health programs. She's been the top advisor in HHS. She spent many years in or representing the private and health insurance sector, and we're delighted to have you with us this morning.
Thank you very much. As you can tell from Ed's introduction of me, I never had the opportunity to work on the Hill through the time that I have been here in Washington, and but have always both respected and enjoyed the process by which legislation gets made. And I think that what we're seeing this week and over this weekend will continue to be very interesting. And this is always the time of year when you're getting close to a session being done where things actually can get accomplished. And I know that both downtown and at HHS and all over town, I think people place bets on the likelihood of certain things happening, and to just track the ups and downs of you know, who's ahead in the betting game has been one form of entertainment over the last week at least, and it continues to not completely be clear who's going to prevail. It's also the time of year at the administration, which is something I am new to, having only been there a couple of months, where we are going through a significant process of figuring out what next year's budget proposal is going to look like, and a lot of the policies that the administration puts forward are always expressed through our budget submission to Congress. In addition, folks are thinking ahead to the State of the Union. And all of the healthcare issues are always on the agenda as we go through both the budget and the State of the Union process. But clearly, I think that this year, in part because of the election, people are far more aware that there's likely to be significant efforts on the Hill with respect to healthcare policies that we need to be determining, as Liz says, where there are areas where we can work together very effectively, where there are areas that we will work together and may not end up in the same place, and we'll see where that takes us and what healthcare policies are going to be things that are very obvious at the beginning, are clear differences between Republicans and Democrats. The administration's principles, I think, remain solid, that we believe in keeping America competitive requires affordable healthcare. Our government has a responsibility to provide health care to the poor and to the elderly. And for all Americans, we must confront the rising cost of care in order to help people afford the insurance coverage they need. We believe in doing this by building on the private sector competitive models in order to ensure that government programs work well. And we believe that health care has to be affordable and transparent, portable, and efficient. And I think you can see that running through a lot of the budget submissions that the administration has put out over the last 6 years. With respect to Medicare, I don't necessarily want to go all the way back and revisit all of the debates around the Medicare drug benefit, but there had been many years of conversation about the need to update the Medicare program and include a drug benefit in Medicare. And as all of you are very well aware, that passed in 2003. And after several years of going through the implementation process, which is when I was at HHS, as Ed mentioned, the Part D benefit got up and running last January. And I think that many of us probably don't stop and take enough time to reflect on what a big accomplishment and change that was in the Medicare program. Medicare had not been changed that radically since 1965 when it was enacted. And in 1965, there were only about 20 million people who were eligible for Medicare. There were some 42-plus million people eligible, I think, in 2006. And so to add a drug benefit that was delivered through private sector models, which is a different way of looking at a benefit than typically beneficiaries were used to, unless they were in Medicare Advantage plans, and educating them about their choices was given all the problems that could have happened, I think the place where we are right now is a tribute both to members of Congress who worked very hard on this, to people in the administration who have worked very hard to get this implemented, and to all the people in the advocacy community who were, and I see Vicky right in front of me, who were kind enough to always let us know where things were going off kilter a little bit. I very much want to express to everybody in the audience how satisfying working on this program has been, and how grateful people in the administration are to folks who spent a lot of time and effort learning about this program and helping beneficiaries learn about their options and get enrolled over the past year. When the program was enacted, people didn't think we would have any plans and we were going to need to have a government fallback plan. Then there was a lot of worry. We had far too many plans and people wouldn't be able to figure out what their choices were, that seniors wouldn't be able to make these choices, that there wouldn't be enough people available to help educate seniors and help enroll them in this program. There was a lot of worry that after low premiums the first year that the drug plans were going to immediately raise their bids. Despite a lot of the implementation issues in the first couple of months of last year, which I think folks are pretty well aware of, involved a lot of systems issues, involved the change of Medicaid beneficiaries onto a Medicare system, involved transition from drugs people were taking onto formularies, et cetera. I think we have come to the second open enrollment period in a pretty good position. Beneficiaries are saving on average $1,200 a year. They could be spending less than half of what people without coverage would pay in the open marketplace, according to Consumers Union, and if they join lower cost plans, they can save even more. Taxpayers are saving too. I know there was a lot of controversy about what the original Medicare drug benefit estimates were when the bill passed. The costs have been significantly lower than was estimated at the time. Part of that has to do with the number of people enrolled. While there are approximately 22 or 23 million people actually enrolled in Part D, there are another 10 or 11 million or so who are covered by creditable coverage either through the retiree subsidy or through federal programs. There are still more people who have credible coverage who the folks who do all this estimating weren't completely aware of the extent of folks who already had drug coverage. So part of this is based on enrollment, part of it is based on competition among the plans, and part of it is based on lower drug price increases over the last couple of years. The plan bids came in 10% lower in the second year than they were in the first year. That is almost unheard of in the private sector, and I know that CMS is watching over that very, very carefully and is working with the plans to ensure, hopefully, that next year is as successful as this year was in terms of plan bids. Beneficiaries have more choices this next year than they had previously, with coverage in the gap in more states. And many beneficiaries chose plans this year or were provided the low-income subsidy, so were not ever subject to the donut hole part of the standard benefit package. And beneficiary satisfaction has been high. I know the Kaiser Family Foundation has done a number of studies since the benefit or the bill passed. Both the work that they have done and the work of others has been consistent over the last 6 months, especially. J.D. Powers, which most of you probably know from the work they do for new automobiles, has also taken on looking at the drug benefit, and they have found that, surprisingly, the Medicare drug benefit has the third highest satisfaction rating of all the products that they survey, new automobiles being number one, and surprising to me, homeowners insurance being number two. If anybody ever asked me a question about homeowners insurance, I'm not sure how I would answer it, but there you have it. The issues surrounding the government non-interference language in the bill, I think, are more major than minor, and we'll all be working very hard on those as we go into the next Congress. I think it's important to remember that that language actually says the government may not interfere in negotiations that are currently ongoing between plans and pharmaceutical manufacturers or between plans and PBMs. It also says the government may not set a formulary, and part of the concern, I believe, with this provision, which was actually originally a part of Democrat drug bill packages prior to the Medicare Modernization Act passing, is a concern that the government would interfere in those kind of negotiations in a way that would skew the marketplace inappropriately and lead to problems with respect to research and development. And frankly, the government doesn't particularly do a very good job in negotiation. And I think that if you take a look at the Part B drug program, and even with all due respect to my friends here on this panel, if you look at what's going on with the tax extenders package, I think the amount of political pressure that comes for any particular piece of Medicare or Medicaid or other public programs as we go through putting legislation together is interesting, and I think it would be a mistake to open up the political process to what particular prices are available for drugs. Anyway, I don't want to spend all of my time on Medicare, but I did want to lay that out for people. Medicare Advantage, as Liz said, is also something that's a program that the administration is very strongly supportive of. One of the other goals of the Medicare Modernization Act was to increase the number of choices available across the country. There were a number of policy decisions made after the Balanced Budget Act in 1997 and also all the way up through 2003 to ensure that those choices were more broadly available. There had been historically a lot of concern that plans in Iowa never had extra benefits, while plans in Florida had zero premiums, lots of drug coverage, lots of additional benefits. That geographic variation has been significantly narrowed, we have seen the growth in those choices over the past 3 years and growth in enrollment in those plans as well. I think with the exception of very few counties, beneficiaries all across America now have a choice of a Medicare health plan option. With respect to expansion of coverage to the uninsured, the position that the administration has taken historically has been to focus on the affordability of coverage, and we have proposed through the budget various ways to do that, including association health plans, including medical liability reform, including making insurance more portable across states. I think all of those things are things we continue to talk about and look at and are supportive of. And as Liz mentioned, the health savings accounts, which were also part of the MMA, have also been a strong part of the administration's approach to providing more affordable health care coverage. The approach we took in last year's budget was to try and level the playing field, the tax playing field, between insurance that's purchased inside the employer-based system and insurance that's purchased outside of that system, as well as healthcare services that you receive through insurance and healthcare services that you receive outside of your insurance system. As Liz mentioned, those things need improvements, and they don't work quite as well if there isn't information available. So the president signed an executive order this summer that is dedicated to working through the federal health care programs to make sure that we make information more transparent, both price information and quality information, that quality information is centered around core performance measurement that people in the provider community have worked to come to consensus on. That we work to get to more interoperable health IT systems, and that we provide more incentives in the system for both providers and consumers to care about the value of the healthcare services that they're purchasing. And I have received the two-minute warning, and so I'm pretty close. Sure, I'm close to the end of that. And the last thing I would say, though, is that in the efforts to comply with the executive order, HHS and CMS have been very active in putting out on their website Medicare payments to providers. Last June, hospital DRGs went up. In August, it was ambulatory surgery center prices. In November, it was hospital outpatient and physician fees. They will continue to do that. They're continuing to work with the Ambulatory Quality Alliance and the Hospital Quality Alliance to get to consensus on core performance measures. And I think the quality reporting that was a part, is presumably a part of what's going on the Hill, is really important to the movement forward of those efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. That was very informative. You can't mix a football metaphor, though, into the baseball one that Drew started. Now let's turn to the House. Wendell Primus is senior policy advisor to House Speaker-elect Nancy Pelosi for budget and health issues. He's an economist. He's held a variety of posts in both the executive branch and on the Hill. A lot of us are forever grateful for his years of work at the Ways and Means Committee on a whole range of topics, but especially being the editor of the Green Book, which those of you who know it know it is a treasure trove of data for health policy wonks everywhere, and you will never outlive our gratefulness, as well as for showing up today. Thanks, Wendell.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, and there really is a lot of excitement on our side of the aisle in Congress. I think the members are ready to get down to work, and I think you'll see right off the bat, especially on the House side, that we're going to work until starting on January 4th and work through the president's recess. It's also good to be batting cleanup here this morning. I'll go back to the baseball analogy because I get a comment on what the other three speakers have said. I think one of the first things I'd say, which is very symbolic of the difference between the Republican priorities and the Democratic priorities, is this lame duck session. We managed, or they managed, to find $1 billion that didn't have to be paid for to improve health savings accounts, which the evidence shows primarily helps the wealthy and healthy among us. But there was not roughly $400 million, a little less than that, to take care of the S-chip shortfall. I'd like to think that we could be proved wrong, but I don't think it's going to happen in this Congress, and that really probably is the symbolic difference between Republicans and Democrats on health care. And if I read these poll results right, I think the American public appreciates the Democratic priorities, because one of the highest things that we think we need to take care of in this country is getting more of the uninsured children with health insurance. I guess another thing I'd say is one of the things that has made the Ryan White funding allocation difficult is the fact that over the last 6 years, the funding per AIDS case has gone down by about a third. I think it's time that reversed. During the 1993 period to 2000, funding per AIDS case went up substantially, and that was a period when we had a Democratic president and mainly a Republican Congress. It also speaks to a lot of other funding priorities in the appropriation process. We've had 11% real cut in NIH funding over the last several years. We've had Title VII basically decimated, and Ryan White and other discretionary programs. I think CDC and HRSA have remained relatively flat. So I think those funding priorities in the appropriation process are going to start to change. I don't know how rapidly, but that will be another difference between the Republican Congress, I think, and what will happen in a Democratic Congress. The other item that hasn't been mentioned to date that is also part of the 100-hour agenda in the House, and both, again, leaderships are committed to this, is a return to pay-as-you-go budgeting. I mean, over the last 6 years, we've seen the largest fiscal turnaround in our nation's history. When President Bush took office, there was $6 trillion or 5.6 projected surpluses. That has turned into a $3 trillion deficit. This president has borrowed more from foreign governors, foreign nations, foreign countries, than all previous presidents combined. And the fastest growing item in the budget is not Medicare, it's not Medicaid, it's interest payments to foreigners on our national debt. That is the fastest growing item, and that is why I think the economy figured a lot larger in the poll results than most people would have expected. I mean, the other reason is that since early 2001, corporate profits went up about 3, 4, 5 percentage points of GDP. They're the highest level since 1950. wages as a share of GDP actually went down substantially. And that is why the first time in our nation's history, median income of non-elderly or working families went down while we had 4 years of economic growth. Unprecedented. So that is why another part of the 100-hour agenda, an increase in the minimum wage, as well as return to pay-as-you-go budgeting, which will have some implications for the health care agenda, is going to be high on the list. And I think you'll see all of those things pass before the State of the Union occurs in on January 23rd. Kate has already mentioned stem cell. I think we'll give the president another chance to veto the stem cell bill. We think that is very important research that ought to be taken place. Julie spent quite a bit of time talking about the prescription drug benefit. We think it is important that the secretary be given the authority to negotiate with drug companies on behalf of all of those enrolled in prescription drug plans. Yes, the cost has not turned out to be as great, but that's primarily because enrollment is about $7 to $8 million less. Drug prices slowed down in 2004 and 2005, not because of the MMA, but because of other trends. And she also indicated that government wasn't a very good negotiator. Well, I'm not so sure. If you look at what prices VA gets, they're substantially less. And I think really a very critical piece of information will be forthcoming. I hope it's forthcoming from the administration by May or June. And we will find out when all the 2006 claims data is in how well the PDPs did in negotiating prices relative to the Medicaid programs. I mean, we have roughly 6.5 million dual eligibles in this country, and one can compare how well the PDPs did to the Medicaid programs. I think that will be a very interesting piece of information that we will find out later this summer. In the meantime, Democrats on both sides of the Hill are committed to giving the president negotiating authority. I think we're still vetting the language, but I think the leading contender right now is to repeal and require. It will be very simple language. We do not think that Congress needs to hammer out all the details. There are a lot of smart people in the administration, including the secretary, that can look at how we're buying drugs in the Ryan White program, in the Medicaid program, Department of Defense, vaccines, et cetera, and figure out the best way of negotiating better prices with drug companies. I think the other thing that hasn't been mentioned, I suspect there'll be a lot of oversight by this Congress in terms of looking at ways we can save money, but also two, I think, very important catastrophes that occurred. Katrina, is there anything that should be done there in terms of supporting health care, et cetera? And another issue that I think will be looming is the people that were affected in cleaning up the 9/11, the pile, the New York City issue. Those workers are getting ill. I think it's the tip of the iceberg. And despite all of our rhetoric about first responders and how important they were, their needs right now are being left unmet. So I would expect to see some oversight hearings on that. I couldn't agree more, and I really hope that we can forge a compromise and that there will be bipartisan support for SCHIP reauthorization so that many more kids will become insured, that we can lower the number of kids who are uninsured that actually went up again, the rate went up in this last census. We can lower that dramatically, and I'm hoping we can work with the Republicans and the White House. In fact, I'm hoping that the president will have a SCHIP proposal in his budget that we can build on and proceed on. I think the other things that Liz mentioned, the HIT bill, genetic non-discrimination, there's some other health agenda items that will be high on the Democratic list. I guess with that, I'll end and be glad to take Q&As.
Terrific. Thank you, Wendell. And let me just say thanks to all the panelists. I know this is an extremely difficult time for you to free up time, and it is very much appreciated. Excuse me, let's try to get in a few questions. I would urge those of you who have a question for Kate to assert yourself early, because she's going to escape and you'll miss your chance. Depending on the question, she may escape sooner rather than later. And I understand there are folks with microphones. You want to identify yourself, sir.
Hi, Rolf Rosenkrantz with Insight CMS. I have two questions. One, maybe for Julie Goon. Are there any kind of initiatives that the president definitely wants to push next year or in the next 2 years, maybe in a way that he has pushed health IT and transparency in the past with executive orders, or maybe some other things that he definitely knows already that he does not want to push or prevent? And then secondly, I want to ask maybe the Democrats on the panel about the Part D reform. Structurally, I'm trying to figure out whether hearings are going to be first or whether the legislation is going to be first, or at least are you thinking that you're going to finish a draft that's workable also with Senator Baucus before he even wants to do hearings?
Pardon me, I don't want to be impolite, but if you can hold your answers to those questions, I would try to elicit a question or two from you for Kate before she has to leave. I believe the gentleman here indicated he was in such a position. Is that right? No. Well, maybe there are no questions for Kate. You were so clear.
Dallas Salisbury with the Employee Benefit Research Institute. I do have a question, which I was going to have before the comments by Wendell, but after that comment even more so. Is we released a survey on consumer-driven health and HSAs yesterday. And in the context of one of the discussions yesterday on the Hill that I was present for, the HSA provision was described as one that could, in fact, elicit a single senator to hold up the entire bill. Is that viewed as an issue in this bill of that level of import in the Senate, or are all the other issues you noted more likely to dominate?
Do you mean the HSA provisions in the extenders bill?
Correct.
Is that what we're talking about? To be 100% honest, we I've been so focused on the NIH whole problem we have, the Ryan White, bioterrorism, BARDA are not going to go through the House per Chairman Barton unless the Senate passes his NIH bill. And there are people on our side who think CHIP has to be done right now, my boss included. We have some real problems coming our way. And that's been sort of the number one focus for us as we post putting together the extenders bill. Obviously, the night the extenders bill was put together, the extenders bill was all we were thinking about. And as we've looked through what ended up in the extenders bill, which were broader HSA provisions than a lot of people were expecting, I think people are still sort of assessing where they're going to be. And I know that there are a number of people who are drafting amendments to the extenders bill. I'll let Liz speak to the likelihood of those amendments seeing the light of day. But I think that we are, right now, people are still looking at the package. It's a big bill. And there's a lot of stuff in there that a lot of senators want. Democrats were pushing for passing extenders for, I don't know if it was months. I think it was months. In the time before we went out for the election. So I think that there's a lot of stuff in there. It's hard to know on balance where people will be. I think people want to help the physicians. We need to extend TMA. We need to extend the moratorium on therapy caps. The extenders I can't really speak to because I don't work on those issues, but I think, there's a lot of stuff in there that people want, and whether that has the weight to carry the HSA expansion, I don't know. Your study is certainly informs people's judgment, consumer satisfaction with those plans, the increasing evidence that those plans are not being coupled with contributions to the accounts that accompany them. The whole idea of sort of shifting risk onto consumers is not something that Democrats are comfortable with. I think that we need to do something about healthcare costs. The answer isn't just switch the cost to patients. So I think there is significant concern about it. I can't say whether it tears down this whole bill. At this point, I think there's a lot of stuff in there that people really want to see. So I think we are sort of waiting that out, and we don't even have the bill yet in the Senate. So we are. We'll see what happens in the House first.
If I can just jump in, as I said at the beginning, it takes one to try and hold something up. It takes 60 to end debate. So I think every member is evaluating and trying to determine where they're going to be on the package. Admittedly, it's a large package. There's a lot of really good things in there, including the HSA provisions from my perspective. The one thing I would say also to comment a little bit on something that Wendell mentioned, the HSA provisions are on the tax side of the ledger, whereas many of the other provisions are on the spending side of the ledger. And again, this is where it comes down to it's very good. It's very easy to come and make comments. It's difficult to actually legislate and find consensus. And I really am looking forward to watching Democrats operate under PAYGO once they reinstate it.
I'm Mary Agnes Carey with CQ. Kate, I just wanted to follow up with you a little bit about the S-CHIP issue. I know you said people are still looking at the package, but how strong is the feeling, from your perspective among Democrats, that these shortfalls must be addressed now? Can they wait to January? If you're running the chamber, will you be able to move something? I'm just trying to figure out if it's strong enough to derail what's happening, the current package we're talking about.
We had hoped S-CHIP was going to be included in the extenders package. It was not. The Senate, in a bipartisan way, said this is what should be in here, and we ended up not getting there, unfortunately. I think that S-CHIP now the question on S-CHIP has become more about Chairman Barton, who has jurisdiction over the S-CHIP program in the Energy and Commerce Committee, has indicated that his number one priority is NIH, and he's going to let Ryan White reauthorization not go through. He's going to let bioterrorism bar not go through if he doesn't get NIH. And I think that right now the S-CHIP debate is more linked up in that because that is his jurisdiction. And Senator Grassley and Senator Baucus have both indicated that they would like to address the shortfall issue too. So I think that it's sort of more tied into that than the extender debate at this point. But I could be wrong as we get to the end of the period of time where NIH, Ryan White, BT BARDA are falling either by the wayside, and extenders is the one thing left, that could shift. It is very important to a number of members of our caucus. It's very important to a number of Republicans. There have been bipartisan letters to my boss and to Liz's boss. I think that everyone recognizes how important it is. I think it's a significant issue. There is serious concern about what's going to happen in some states right away if we don't do it. They can't wait until CHIP reauthorization is finalized. We clearly want to do CHIP reauthorization early. We think it's an important thing, and it's really an opportunity for us to do something to improve a program that's near and dear to Democrats and Republicans' hearts. So I think I agree with Liz, that is an opportunity to work together. And I think that there are people who think we can't wait for the CHIP shortfalls to be addressed until that happens. And so I think it's a significant issue. I think it's going to tie us up for a little bit. And I think, the people who are from states that are going to experience the shortfalls and have children with their coverage in jeopardy, that's their obligation as members who are representing those states and those children. The Center on Budget has estimated that over 600,000 children have their coverage in jeopardy. How do you go home and say, I didn't fight for that? So I think it's a significant issue. And I think I don't know what the likelihood is that we're going to be able to prevail on getting that done. I think that it's a heavy lift at this point. And that's especially true with the House closing down the rule on the extenders package. It's especially true with them and their suspension calendar and the likelihood that, not to say anything bad about the House, but they tend to just send stuff over and leave town. And, you know, we would do that too, but for our members who keep us in, I'm sure. But, you know, we don't have that luxury. So I think we'll see whether there's any way to get it done. And but it is going to tie things up. I think it's going to be a big issue. And whether we can get anything done on shortfalls and if we can come to some kind of agreement that Chairman Barton can live with from his Texas perspective, and that's the state he represents, I'm saying, you know, we are trying to work with him and trying to get it done, and I'm not maligning anyone, but that, you know, he's decided to hold Ryan White hostage to the NIH bill. A lot of people on our side think NIH can be reauthorized next year, and they want CHIP now. So, you know, we're sort of, it's the classic who's going to blink, and I don't know who that is at this point.
If I can just, one additional comment on that, I would agree with Kate to the extent that there is a little bit of brinksmanship going on right now, which is unfortunate, and it is one of the things that can happen as we get towards the end of the year. I would say, in all fairness to where CHIP is or is not in the extenders package, that on the Senate side, the extenders package is not only a bicameral agreement, but it's a bipartisan agreement. So there was a lot of discussion about SCHIP and whether to include it or not. I understand greatly the disappointment that it's not included, and I think that I can appreciate that. I think the other thing we have to think about, though, and this will be part of why I think the reauthorization discussion is so important, is that some of the states that are in shortfalls are covering many more than children. They are covering childless adults up to a significant level of the significant percentage of the poverty level. So there are going to be some serious policy debates. Clearly, we do not want anyone to be dropped from coverage. And that is why, from the Senate perspective, on a bipartisan basis, we have been saying that we will act as quickly as we possibly can on SCHIP when it comes to reallocation and to addressing the shortfalls. But there are some policy issues that need to be addressed as well. And it is unfortunate that there is some holding up going on. It's going on both sides of the aisle.
For those that may be having some difficulty following this, there are two children's health insurance issues here. The first, which is part of what's being considered right now in what they call the extenders, which is a series of legislative additions that are really meant to be short-term fixes or appropriations issues, is the issue of whether states that have hit the cap on their federal funding for SCHIP can get a bump up in that cap so that they can continue to receive federal matching funds and cover children. But next year, 2007, the entire state children's health insurance SCHIP legislation is up to be reauthorized by the Congress and will, as Molly noted in her overview of public opinion support, be the major vehicle by which we look at how we cover children through public programs in this country. So there's two issues, one immediate about the funding levels, and the second will come up in the 110th Congress as how they deal with children. Similarly, there's a number of Medicare provisions here that are extending or changing provisions, but it is not a major piece of legislation that is redoing Part D. That'll wait to see if anyone wants to propose that, though the public wasn't supportive of that. They wanted minor fixes in our public opinion work. But just to keep the field a little clearer here.
Wendell had a comment.
Just one last comment on this SCHIP HSA thing, and that is, I want to be very clear. I mean, the reason we had so much difficulty getting to cover the SCHIP shortfall was because of the demand that it'd be paid for. I mean, we could have done like we did last year and put 350 or 80 million bucks on the table, and there would have been no problem. We wouldn't have had to hurt Texas or any other state that still has some SCHIP surpluses. So because one had to be paid for and the HSAs didn't have to be paid for is why we're in the bind we're in.
Just on that point, though, if I can, and I know you don't want to get on back and forth. One of the things, again, about the difficulty of governing and budget rules is that just adding additional funding, it's not like we can just throw a couple hundred million dollars into this program, even if we had a couple hundred million dollars to throw into it because of CBO scoring rules, where they actually build that into the baseline. And so what seems like 300 million or a couple hundred million actually is billions. So again, difficulty of governing presents itself and rears its ugly head on a regular basis, and CBO rules are CBO rules.
Hi, I'm Jim Byrne. I'm editor of Healthcare Disparities Report. A narrow question for you, Ms. Hall. I
Excuse
assume.
Me just a second. Can you hear him in the back?
Oh.
I don't know. Why don't we try another one?
Yeah. Oh, there we go. I assume that the bipartisan disparities bill that Senator Frist and the three Democrats introduced probably is not going anywhere the rest of the session. It's not going to be tossed on anything.
As much as we'd love to get that bill done, because we worked well over 2 years on that bipartisan agreement, I think what I would say is that I think both our Democratic co-sponsors and our Republican co-sponsors and ourselves, we pushed the envelope on both the Republican and the Democratic sides as far as we could to get agreement, a bipartisan agreement. And so I think that we're going to need to spend a lot of time with our colleagues trying to make sure that they understand the policy and are comfortable with the policy. And unfortunately, because it took us as long as it did to get that legislation drafted and reach that agreement, we have not had as much time as we'd like to make sure that all of our colleagues are educated. So my guess on the prospects, it's not going to be added on to anything last minute, because most of what we can do is either in the extenders package developed or our standalone bills that we can pass by unanimous consent or on the suspension calendar in the House. So unfortunately, I don't think that it's going to go, but that is not a reflection on the commitment of the leader. And in his new capacity, I expect that he will continue and probably have a little bit more time to devote to it.
I have a broader question that would I'm interested in the views of the people from the Hill and the administration. On Monday, the National Academy of Social Insurance came out with a very carefully worked out proposal to use Medicare as an engine of going directly after disparities. And it involves things that can be done in the executive branch by CMS and the like, but it includes some legislative proposals too. If that's not a super costly proposal, I don't think it's been costed out yet, is that something the Hill and the administration would be very sympathetic to looking at?
I'm not aware of what exactly the National Academy for Social Insurance proposed, but I would point out that a number of the items that were in the MMA were very specifically directed or can have very specific impacts on this disparities issue. Number one, all of the preventive screening benefits that were added to the Medicare program are in many cases related to diseases that disproportionately affect people in minority communities. Number two, the drug benefit has seen higher rates of enrollment among African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans as opposed to Caucasians. In part, that is more than likely because many Caucasians have access to retiree drug coverage. At least that's the belief over at CMS that's caused the difference in the percentages. But as people get access to drug coverage in combination with those preventive screenings, there is definitely an expectation at CMS that this is going to have a very positive effect on health disparities. And I know that as we went into this open enrollment period, they were spending a lot of time actually trying to promote the Welcome to Medicare physical as well as the preventive screenings that are now available as a part of the Medicare program.
I'm Susan Denser from the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and I have a question for Wendell, and then I'd love to hear Julie's response. Wendell, you mentioned on the question of government negotiation that the emerging idea was repeal and require, as distinct from some of the other things under discussion, like creating a separate government-sponsored plan. Could you elaborate on why that course as opposed to others? And Julie, would the president veto a law that specifically repealed the non-interference provision and required him or the secretary to negotiate?
In the first 100 hours, we are not going through regular order, so there's no hearings. It's not going through the committee process, and therefore a decision was made that any proposal here has to be quite simple. In fact, you know, if you look at all of them, minimum wage, student loan, they're all pretty simple, but they send a very clear message that the Democrats can govern and we care about the American people and the middle class. And so the two leading contenders here were just repeal the non-interference language, but given the administration's opposition to doing anything. I think there was a feeling we had to do a little bit further and go to repeal the non-interference as well as require the secretary to actually negotiate. I think the other proposal that was on the table for a while, and that is creating a Medicare Part D, you know, may eventually come with hearings, et cetera. But it was not something that we were comfortable legislating in the first 100 hours because it takes time to develop that kind of legislation, and that kind of legislation needed to go through the committee process.
Well, I appreciate the insight into the Democratic leadership's thinking on what they would like to do in the first 100 hours. I would say I think that it is not clear to me what repeal and require would actually mean or do. It's not clear how that would work. Would it work in the current with the current private sector plans? Does that mean the government would have to get in there and figure out by plan how many drugs were covered of each particular drug on formulary, and what would they then end up doing with respect to interfering between the process between the PBMs and the drug companies, between the PBMs and the pharmacists? Just saying you're going to repeal and require something doesn't really tell you how something would work, and so it's difficult to actually respond operationally to that. I think that the philosophical objections that we have to getting rid of the non-interference clause and to requiring any kind of negotiation stand, there would be certainly be advice that would go forward that would reflect all of the both intellectual and operational thinking inside the administration about this issue.
Vicki Gottlisch, Center for Medicare Advocacy. I have two separate questions that affect low-income people primarily. The first for Wendell is what's going to happen with Medicaid, and in particular some of the issues around documentation of citizenship, which seems to be a real burden for people. And then the second one is really for Julie, and this is a policy question. We saw in the polling that was released earlier that people don't want to put more co-payments onto Medicare beneficiaries as a way to save Medicare costs. It's very likely that the trustee report is going to come out in March and show that more than 45% of Medicare monies will become from general revenue within the time frame of the MMA. And I was wondering whether the administration had begun to think about how they want to change the Medicare package in order to have some cost savings in Medicare in response to those reports. And then the third thing I want to say is if we could answer Rolf's questions, because I was interested in the answer.
About Medicaid.
Vicki, as you know, that every Democrat in the House opposed the Deficit Reduction Act changes, and particularly the primary reason for that opposition was the Medicaid changes, including the citizen thing that you referenced. There is a package of DRA technicals that are in the extender package that I think improve the situation a bit. I don't know if it goes as far as you'd like to have, but we think those technicals are important, and they've been worked on a bipartisan basis, and I think they take the rough edges off of that documentation requirement.
And I thought, and maybe Liz can answer this, I thought there was actually something that was going on in here that was even, well, maybe that's just what you were referring to, Wendell, that took the rough edges off of this. I thought there was a little tweak. With respect to not wanting to require seniors to pay more costs out of pocket, the other thing I thought that was interesting about this very same question was how high requiring higher income seniors to pay higher premiums was. And given that we're starting into the transition period where, as a result of another one of the provisions of MMA, higher income seniors will be beginning to pay a higher Part B premium next year, and I think it's a three-year transition period. But there's been a lot of concern about that that's been expressed as well, and a lot of not knowing exactly what was going to go on as seniors began to see that reflected in their Social Security payments. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out as well. As we get to the trustees report and what it in fact is going to say, people are very aware of that, and we're talking about how to address some of those issues beyond even just that particular trigger. As many of you know, there have been a lot of conversations inside the administration about the whole issue of entitlements reform and how to slow the growth in entitlements programs, including Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and those conversations continue, and more will be forthcoming at appropriate points in time when people more important than me get to make news, which is basically my answer to Bob's question as well.
And to parallel what Drew Altman said earlier, we have time for one or two more questions. We have two on the aisle, so to speak.
Neither side of the aisle.
Yes, I'm Judy Riggs. I'm a health policy person with the Alzheimer's Association. Wendell, to follow up on the PAYGO issue and thinking now about the longer-term issues that we discussed earlier today, it seems like if we're ever really going to address these broader healthcare issues of cost and coverage, we're going to have to do something about the budget rules. Because, you know, and the way the budget rules work in terms of how you cost changes in one program and considering the impact of those changes on other programs and tax expenditures, or looking beyond the immediate cost to long-term savings, are there any ways that the Democrats can start thinking about that? And can you really do health care reform, major changes in health care and in the entitlement programs, without doing something about the budget rules?
And could I just add a little footnote to that question? You might just explain what PAYGO is and what the Democrats are planning to propose as changes to the current rules.
PAYGO rules basically mean that anytime you want to spend more, you have to offset it by spending cuts or revenue increases, or anytime you want to grant a tax cut, that has to be paid for either by spending reductions or tax increases, so that you don't increase the deficit. And that is something that we've been about for the last 6 years, and we think it affects economic growth and a lot of other things, and why we need to restore fiscal discipline. Yes, it does make it tougher. But there are things in the healthcare. I mean, the Commonwealth issued a report a couple days ago that suggested that managed care providers were getting a 12% additional subsidy rather than the fee-for-service world. We think there's no reason that playing field should be so unlevel. So there are some offsets that can be gone about. I think the idea of an entitlement commission on Medicare is premature. You know, there's lots of ideas out there, including HIT, including better chronic care management, maybe cost effectiveness. But you're right. You know, the savings from those are going to be very difficult, and it's not clear. You know, I'll give you one factoid, and that is 23% of the Medicare beneficiaries have five or more chronic conditions. They see 13 docs on average, and they consume about 68% of the Medicare dollar. Well, can we get both improve the quality of care as well as slow down cost if those doctors talk to one another, coordinate the care, et cetera? Well, the answer is we don't really know. And that's why there's not a set of well-developed policy choices that we can turn to slow down Medicare's growth rate. In fact, Medicare's growth rate is less than what's been happening in the private sector. So it will make life difficult, but life has to be made more difficult because we can't keep increasing the deficit as we have done.
I'm Chris Lee with the Washington Post. Everyone sort of alluded to one way or another the problem of the uninsured. I guess it's something like 46 million people now, and it's going up, and the number of children who are uninsured are going up. So I was going to ask if you could talk about what specifically the Congress might look at to address that, and Ms. Goon, how that might square with the principles you laid out before about expanding health insurance coverage.
I'll start the answer and others can jump in. I'd say, you know, one thing about the number of 46 million uninsured, yes, it's a census number that we get every year, and that's uninsured at one point during the year. And the reasons that they're uninsured, if you start to delve into the numbers, and you should probably pose a question to Dallas because he's done a lot of that, are very, very diverse. Some of it has to do with, does the employer offer? Some of it has to do with the premiums by which an employer offers. Some of it has to do with just personal choice and not wanting to, for a lot of young people, not wanting to spend money on health coverage. So trying to address the uninsured, from my perspective, from I think the Republican perspective, is very much multifaceted, and there is no one answer to that question. I think that a number of the proposals that we have tried to present are lower cost options, are additional choices, and really, if you look at some of the things that we have proposed, particularly on the tax side, are true incentives and trying to create some parity between those who have access to employer-sponsored coverage and those who don't, who would purchase it individually. So I think that's just a few. There is a whole spectrum, and I think Julie can talk about what the president has proposed. There's a whole spectrum of ways that you can deal with that. Ultimately, though, from at least my boss's perspective, the only way that we truly start to address the problem is to look at cost, and that is through transparency and information. And as consumers, taking responsibility for figuring out and working with your providers. And in healthcare, it's very difficult. There are a lot of difficult choices. We're talking about, in many, many circumstances, life and death choices. But taking some responsibility, taking some time to learn the options that are available. Again, we clearly need to provide much more information to really make that possible and provide that information in a way that individuals can really understand, process, and use it.
Just to follow up on Liz very quickly, and Dallas, I'm sorry, I haven't seen the results of the survey work that you did. I think, in the conversations that or in the speeches that I've heard the people that I work with give, in part on consumer-directed health plans and HSAs, one of the things I think that we do feel very strongly is that employers should be contributing to the funds of folks who are moving into consumer-directed health plans. If consumer-directed health plans are going to cost employers less, you know, a smart employer is going to take at least a significant chunk of that savings, apply to the HSA, in part as an incentive to get employees to look at this as a particular option. It's not necessarily about shifting risk onto the employee. It is about shifting responsibility for thinking about things. If you have a plumbing problem that's a minor plumbing problem, you know, you do have a chance to search around for somebody that might provide the best and most cost-effective plumbing system. If you have a flood in your basement, you're probably going to call the first person who actually picks up the phone and says they can get to your house in 20 minutes. So it's not, you know, it's not necessarily different in other sectors of the economy as well. To the parity issue, I think it's important that we ask ourselves why people who are purchasing insurance coverage outside the employment system don't have the same tax advantage that people who purchase it inside the employer system do. With respect to the concern that people in consumer-directed health plans and HSAs tend to be healthier than others, if that is getting uninsured people into the insurance risk pool, that is not a bad thing. And so if what happens as a result of consumer-directed health plans is that insurance companies who have this as part of their product, you know, their range of products, are actually getting people who have by choice chosen not to purchase insurance because they're healthy and they're young and they don't think they need it, I think at the end of the day that helps throughout the system as we're looking at the uninsured, because it's important to get those people insured as well. With respect to government-run programs, I think that we'll probably all have a lot to talk about with SCHIP reauthorization coming up in particular. But I also think that it's important to ask the question about whether having all kids covered, including higher income children, is a more important policy priority than actually looking at more of the lower income adults who are currently uninsured. And if you move to a system that covers all kids, what crowd out factor does that have in coverage that children currently have through the employment system and with their families?
I guess I'll reemphasize that I think, you know, this will be a healthy debate within the Democratic caucus, but my sense of where the Democratic caucus is that we want to use the SCHIP reauthorization to take a large step forward in reducing the number of uninsured, basically the number of uninsured children. That's not to say that there won't be other proposals, but my sense, again, of where the Democrats and my boss is at is that we can use SCHIP as, and also your polling results kind of add fuel to that, if you will, or confirm that that might be the right choice. So that's where I expect to go. And, you know, I just heard this administration argument, well, maybe we shouldn't cover higher income kids. I mean, the truth is that one of the uninsured numbers here is that there's a lot of children that are eligible for SCHIP and Medicaid that currently aren't enrolled, and we need to do something about that as well. And I look forward to a proposal from the administration that truly reduces the number of uninsured. It's gone up by 6 million over the last 6 years. And if they really want to put more emphasis on lower income other adults, we'd like to work with them and see that proposal. I don't think that's an argument against not doing a very good job in SCHIP. The last thing I'll say, there's been a lot of talk about consumer-driven health care, and that if we just make the consumer more knowledgeable, all-knowing, somehow the health care system will come into balance, et cetera. I think that is just completely false. Yes, we ought to have informed consumers, but the key decision-making in our health care delivery system is the doctor. And once you've been diagnosed with cancer or diabetes or heart problems, you know, you're on a course of a care where you're going to be spending a lot more money than any other consumer. And cost constraint is not the primary factor. It's the quality of care that Americans want. And I will bet that the cardiac surgeons in this town know what hospital is the best in terms of infection, et cetera. And American consumers are going to put a lot of trust in their physician to get the best care. And so I think if we want to do something about both the quality of care and expenditures, we've got to give the doctors, align the incentives right. We also have to figure out whether the new device, the new drug, or the new procedure is better than the old. Not mandating it necessarily, but finding out whether the new drug is better than the existing drug. And that means that we need to develop more evidence so that the doctor, the key decision maker, can make better decisions on behalf of the consumer.
And I think we would definitely agree with strengthening the role in the relationship between the doctor and the patient.
And I would also just put in a plug, there's a great Frist Bingaman bill that was built on an administration proposal to make sure that those kids who are not enrolled get enrolled. And we'd love to see that enacted next year.
Well, we clearly saw this morning that the public expects action on coverage, action on costs in health care, and gave the priority, if you had to make some choices, at covering kids. We know that this has been a long morning, but we hope it has been an insightful morning in terms of both the public expectations and the difficulty that Congress is going to face as it tries to meet those public expectations, especially around a more active government role. But we have come to the end of our program, and we have lunch outside for those of you who can pick up the box lunch. Others watching on TV are not here to do so. And I want to thank Ed and the panel for being here today with us, and also for our morning panel for setting us off on this course. Thank you.
I don't.